Hey everybody, it's George from Gaming My Whole Life. Welcome to episode 25. Today we're going to be doing a solo take. Unfortunately, my fellow podcasters won't be able to join me this time. However, I have arranged for the next recording where Jamel will be joining us and we will be discussing Microsoft's E3 conference as promised. For now, I didn't want him to miss out on that exciting conversation, and recently I've been playing a game which is very close to my heart and has given me inspiration for a fantastic topic. And that game I've been playing has been on the Nintendo Switch, Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy. So that's the remakes of the old Crash Bandicoot games, which originally came out on the PS1. So Crash Bandicoot, Crash 2, and Crash Bandicoot 3, Warped. Now, the reason why I wanted to discuss this was not so much how much I've enjoyed the game, which I have. Like, it has been a very entertaining experience, it has been nostalgic, and it has definitely felt like it was worth my money. What it has made me remember and has triggered all the inspiration inside of me is the difficulty which you may have already heard about. One of the things which stood out to gamers the most when this game released on the other platforms back on the 30th of June last year, so 2017, everyone was talking about how hard the game was. And there was a few different theories going about. One was, Vicarious Visions, the ones who developed the game, the remake I should say, confirmed that the hitbox detection has been changed. So hitbox is when you have a 3D character running around, there's a hitbox. There's literally a box around them which you can't see, and it reacts when you hit other objects. So for example, if Crash tries to run off the screen and you have the magic wall, which you can't see what's blocking you, but for some reason you just can't run off, there's a wall there, and the hitbox, which is around the Crash Bandicoot character, which you can't see, only the coders can, when that box hits another box, it does something. Normally that something is player death animation, or stop moving, what have you. So that was the one theory, that the hitbox was moved, it didn't line up with your jumps, and so it was easier to fall down holes and get killed by enemies. The other theory was that games were just a lot harder back then. And gamers of today have been spoiled, and if they're young, they don't know any better, and that's just how gaming was. So that's what I wanted to discuss, because it has been such an eye-opener for someone like myself who prides themselves in their gaming skills. I'm, to be honest, the type where if a game is difficult and I hear it's difficult, just out of some nerdy satisfaction, I'm probably going to play the game just so I can beat it, just so I can feel good about it. I don't know why. I guess it's my competitive side. What has not been discussed, at least in the articles that I've read, is I love the no hand-holding that the Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy does. As soon as you start, you just figure out quickly two buttons. You can jump, you can spin. Other than that, the whole world is open to you and you learn everything through multiple deaths, and it is glorious. It's not frustrating. It's glorious. I love the fact that you die in one hit and it becomes so frustrating because it forces you to play by the game's rules. Now, that's what I want to highlight here. You play by their rules. The developers aren't trying to make you happy. They're not trying to even guide you. They're saying, hey, this is the world. This is Crash's world. You want to make it to the end of the stage? You play by our rules. What are the rules? You'll figure it out. That's the start and that's the end of the tutorial that does not exist, and I respect it so much for it. I'm paying attention to all the details, the animation speeds of the enemies. Like, yeah, sure, they die in one hit, but so do you if you don't have that Ooga Booga floating awesome mask thing. You will die in one shot. So if you need to make a difficult jump and need to make sure that you don't get hit by an enemy throwing whatever they're throwing at you, and you need to jump in the air, you need to spin, you need to deflect that item, you need to land in the right spot, then you need to move because that's a platform that crumbles and drops, and then you need to jump onto the other platform and jump off a bird and land on yet another one, and then another platform, which is moving. So if you don't time all this perfectly, you will die. And it is not for those who don't have patience. I was quite impatient when I first started playing. I kept dying and dying because there's a extra stage which they included in it, and it wasn't actually included in the original. It was the Stormy Ascent stage. Now, you would think I would play the game a little bit, get used to it again, and then try tackle that. No, I made that my first stage. I went straight to it. I spent hours playing it, almost beat it. I need to come back to it. And it whooped my butt the whole time, and I couldn't help but respect it. Timing everything. It reminded me of how things were and how things are now. Now, I'm not going to get all old Gramps and, it's so easy these days of regenerating health and all this stuff. No, not at all. But I do like the fact that there was unspoken rules that were followed during the 90s and early 2000s in video games. Rules that seem to be well and truly broken now. The number one rule was things weren't explained. You'd have to figure it out. It was part of the joy. You jumped into the game world, whether it was a platformer, whether it was an RPG, whatever it was, you just figured it out. You went ahead. I remember as a kid, the first thing you would do, and as a teenager and even an early adult later on, first thing you do is pick up the game controller, you press all the buttons. Then you press all those buttons in different combinations. Then you smash all the buttons together at the same time, and you spend a good 2-3 minutes just figuring out as much control as possible and then moving on. And whenever you died, and I'm experiencing this in Crash Bandicoot Insane Trilogy, you don't get angry. You don't get frustrated. It's always I wasn't paying attention. It wasn't, this game is stupid, there's a delay with the jump, there's this excuse, there's that excuse. It's like, okay, my mistake. And then I'll get right back into it, thankfully it reloads really quickly, and then I'll die yet again. Like, I don't learn. I never once got angry at the game. All right, I got a little angry, because that stage is really hard, but anger that just went very quickly as I laughed at myself, and I played it once more. I think even today's developers can learn from these past games and just refresh their own memory, because a lot of the developers, they worked on these old games that we look at, these old games that we refer to, they worked on them as well. What of course happened is game development got a lot more expensive, being a game publisher became more risky, and so the number one goal then became accessibility. And the truth of the matter is that no one enjoys playing a game they feel they're bad at. Very few people, let me correct, because I am part of that exception, and there's many gamers that are part of that exception, but when you want to reach as many people as possible, you want anyone to be able to pick up your product and have fun, you sadly want it to be as easy as possible initially. You want them to have the tutorial. You want them to know how to play it, because not everyone has the patience. A lot of people, if you gave Crash Bandicoot to a young player or even young teenager, and you just give it to them, nothing's explained and they just play and they die 3, 4, 5 times straight. Within 20 minutes, if that's a thing that still happens, they're going to walk away. Now, this isn't young shaming. I'm sure there's young gamers who love the challenges, and that's why they play games like Dark Souls. You always hear anything difficult being compared to Dark Souls or Cuphead, you know? Whereas back in the golden PS1, PS2 days, you didn't really think of the word hard. You just accepted it. When I would think about Crash Bandicoot before playing this remake, I actually couldn't even remember that it was hard, because when I played it, I just accepted that's how it was. It never occurred to me this game's hard, and then made the mental memory this game's hard. And then when I came back to it, I'm like, yeah, it's still hard. It's like, no. This is the first time that I've seen this game as challenging. I just accepted and played, and it didn't even matter. I never thought about how many times I've died in a game. Whereas these days, I certainly do. If I play a game and these days and I lose and I'm challenged by it, I'm genuinely pleasantly surprised and shocked. It's like, oh wow, it's been ages since a game has actually whooped my butt and forced me to pay extra attention to my environments, because that's what happens. When you play a game and it's difficult, but you're enjoying it, so you keep moving forward, you obviously want to stay alive as long as possible, so you will pay extra attention to things which, if the game wasn't so hard, you wouldn't have paid attention. I will use Stormy Ascent, the stage which I was playing, the very difficult one, which, fun fact, was not included in the original Crash Bandicoot because Naughty Dog, who they're the ones that first created the Crash series before selling it off, Naughty Dog felt that it was too hard. It would be too hard. And they were right. They were right. They were 100% right. Another thing which this game reminded me of was the fact that most games would include secrets and secret areas. It was pretty much expected. And just like the difficulty, it was an unspoken rule. While playing Crash and trying to stay alive, quite frankly, I kept seeing out-of-reach areas or some breakable boxes in very difficult places, which I'd look and I couldn't even figure out how to get to it. But it was always there. It was always teased. It was never really said either. You wouldn't have signs randomly popping up saying, hey, do you realize that there's benefits to getting all the boxes, yeah? You can unlock things and you can get a gem, and if there's 50 crates in the stage, can you get all 50? And what does that mean? It was just there. Nothing is explained. You are given so much respect to figure things out. When you first do a stage, you see the boxes, there's Wumpa fruits in them. It's fun to smash them, you know, you do your Tasmanian devil spin move and you just do it for kicks. At the end of the stage, the game's like, hey, you missed out on 15 crates. And how does the game tell you this? By literally dropping all 15 crates one after another very quickly in succession on Crash's head. And then you just move on. And you can ignore this for a while. But you start to realize that every time I finish a stage, they keep dropping those crates on my head. It doesn't punish me. Doesn't do anything bad, but it annoys me and it reminds me without telling me to collect it. And so then I found myself deliberately going after the boxes. And there's something sweet about while you're playing a game you're enjoying, knowing that once you finish it, you know you need to revisit every stage and find all those crates or those bonus stages and secrets and whatnot. And I love modern gaming. I get the latest and greatest games. I spend countless hours playing them. I have my own podcast series. I'm talking to everyone in my Facebook group, Positive Gaming Space, every single day. I obviously can't get enough of gaming. But man, would I just like to go back to those golden days, to the PS1 days, to the Nintendo 64 days, where 3D was new, where developers were giving it their all, where every single game had secrets, and replay value and replayability was such an important thing. I remember reading game reviews back then with the PlayStation magazine, where they would be, the reviewers would be, this was a good game, but you know what? It was short. It didn't have any replayability. It was a bit buggy. Gave it a bad review. These days that doesn't exist. If it's a short game, it's still accepted because people don't really stand by the standard. You see, a lot of these genres were defined years and years ago, right? During that time, they taught us how long to expect certain games to last. When you bought a fighting game, you knew roughly how many fighters to expect. And each fighter would have their own story. You would want to beat the game with every single fighter in arcade mode, see what the story is. And of course, you have your co-op, you know, one-on-one fights against each other. It was expected. If you played an RPG, you knew anywhere between, you know, 50 to 100 hours that was set. You played a platformer, you knew that would last you a certain amount of time. You expected a certain level of polish with these genres. I'm not saying that there wasn't bad games during that time. There was some horrible games which you really have to question how in the world they even found a publisher, let alone how any sales could have even resulted. But it was, I just love that Crash takes me back there. And they're working that Spyro the Dragon game. They're working on Medieval. I haven't heard anything of such, but I would love a Siphon Filter remake of 1 and 2 and 3. Really good game series. And even a remake of Dino Crisis. I would love so much a remake of Dino Crisis 2. That game was its own gem. I could rant on and on and on about it, but I won't, at least in this episode. So I want to get an idea out there. This idea's been on my mind for quite a while, and it's a daring, stupid, yet bold idea. Damn, I can talk myself up. Or at least make it sound like I know what I'm on about. What I'm talking about is, you know how I mentioned that, hey, games need to be as easy as possible, and by easy, I simply mean accessible as possible, to not scare off too many new players because you need a lot of sales because games cost so much money. Now, how this works is, yeah, games cost a lot. They look gorgeous. They have the amount of people which would work on a PlayStation 1 game compared to the amount of people that work on a PlayStation 4 game is incomparable. That's how much. I mean, during the PS1 days, you and a group of mates, there can be three, four of you. There can be two of Crash Bandicoot was made by two people. You didn't need much. You needed time. You needed commitment. But you didn't need the army of people and the amount of money. And even though games have become much, much more expensive to make, you still buy them at pretty much the same price. In a lot of respects, they're actually even cheaper these days. So what can we do about it? My idea, and people are not going to like it, and even I don't like it to an extent, but I feel it's a trade-off, is if you spend, we'll make things simple. Let's say you spent $1 million making a game. That game sells on store shelves for 60 American, 80 Australian, or wherever you're from. You're going to need to sell X amount of copies, hundreds of thousands of copies, in order to break even. in order to hit your original investment of $1 million. And keep in mind, apart from indie games, no games are made for $1 million now. Games are 60 to 100 million and more. We're talking insane numbers. So they need insane sales. They need to get so many people. They need to get everyone to buy the game to break even. And I'm not saying they can't. I'm not saying they don't. The gaming industry is much bigger than before. Word of mouth is a lot more powerful because we have social media. We have the internet. Developers get their money. Don't get me wrong. But one idea that comes to my mind is, what if a developer steps up? And this developer takes everything seriously. They're like Nintendo, in a way, where they will spend however much time is needed on the game. They will make sure it is filled to the brim with content. No DLCs, no microtransactions. You get the complete game. Now, and they improve and work on everything. Everything about the game is good. The animations are perfect. The sound, perfect. Programming, perfect. No glitches, no nothing. It's just a masterpiece, and it's made with the difficulty which suits more older, veteran players, or just gamers who are young, but they like to challenge. What if we told them, you can make the game as hard as you want. I don't want you to even think about the casuals. I just want you to make games that we have always dreamed of. Make them challenging. Make them bloody. Make them wonderful. Make the ultimate ninja game. Make the ultimate fighting game. Don't worry about tutorials. Don't worry about easing people in. Assume we already have the skill set. And what's in it for the developers? What if we pay more money? That is the agreement, like a weird ass Kickstarter or something. So if developers only had to sell half, stay with me, no one likes the idea of spending more money, and I'm not rich, trust me, so I don't like the idea either. But what if developers going in, when they work on their masterpiece for 4 or 5 years, whatever, and while making it, they only need to sell half the amount to break even, because we're willing to pay double for it. See, one thing which I've noticed, a little bit of self-reflection as I've gotten older, as an adult, is, and especially as a gamer, is gamers don't so much mind spending money or spending extra money as long as they feel value. If you go and buy a game and it's really cheap and you feel it's good value, it's actually a good game and it's been on sale for a while, awesome, you buy it. If you buy a $100 game and it's disappointing, you're not happy. You're disappointed. You know you would have been more satisfied if you bought that $70 game. But what if you went and you bought that $200 game, and this game blew your mind? I'm talking, they didn't hold back. It's like, think about this for PC gamers' perspective. I think this would be the best way to get my vision out there. Is, it's no secret that the graphics envelope that games are at have been held back by gaming consoles, which can't be helped. Gaming console comes out, it has whatever hardware is in there, and then that hardware doesn't really change, you know, and developers have to work around it. Now, when a big company such as, I don't know, Ubisoft or whatever, make their huge multi-platform game, and they've spent hundreds of millions of dollars, they want to sell it to as many people as possible because they're still charging the same rate for video games as they did God knows how many years ago. They're still doing it. They need to make the numbers. So, of course, the consoles get priority, and then the PC just gets normally just a little bit of a bump up. It's what, the best way to put this is, what the latest state of the art gaming PCs can do, and the games you see do not match up. Today's most current, biggest graphics cards, strongest everything, run circles, laps around any and every single game that comes out, and will for many years until the consoles catch up. Now, what if a PC developer stepped up and they're like, right, we're only going to make PC games, and we're going to charge you a buttload of money for the game. I'm talking at least $200 for that one game. But you know what? We're not going to hold back on anything. We're not going to hold back on graphics, our vision, the capabilities. We want to make a game that is not even possible, can't be ported, won't be ported. You're going to get the absolute best experience. And all we're asking is, we obviously don't want to be bankrupt after. Buy the game for the higher value. Guarantee us you'll buy it. We will make the dream. That's the idea. I hope I've been able to communicate it well. It's an odd idea, but what I think about is, think of any game which you love, that you feel to this day hasn't been matched, whether it's an old one, whether it's a new one. To use some modern examples, Zelda Breath of the Wild. That game was worked on by Nintendo for donkey years, for a long time. Came out, absolute masterpiece, right? And you won't see other developers take that chance. They're not going to put in the time and the resources into it, because it's a risk. They need to get those numbers. But what if we told developers, hey, spend as much time as Nintendo did, and you can charge us more for it? And of course, you know, that means we'll be willing to pay more for the Nintendo games. But imagine how much more effort Nintendo would even put if they knew their fans were willing to pay. I think anyone is willing to pay for quality. I would be content with playing less games every year if every time a game did come out, it was better, it was bigger, it was bolder, and whatever platform it was on, it pushed things. So then it isn't a numbers game, then it becomes a quality game. So say at the end of the year, you've played, I don't know, 30, 40 games, more, depending how into it you are. What if you had the option just playing 10 games, and each game pushes things? Each game you pay more for, but these games as an average is like a 9 out of 10 minimum. Pretty much everything that comes out is a 10 out of 10. Imagine you had a new Zelda every month, a new Witcher 3 every month, a new Grand Theft Auto, a new whatever floats your boat. Imagine you could have it right now, but you need to pay more. If you're an adult, if you have a job, if you have the money, would you be willing to do it? Me? I would be willing to do it. And this is coming from someone who's addicted to Steam sales, who would just stalk the stages, the Steam page, until that game I want is ridiculously cheap, and then I buy it, and then I get that value for money. But what if we were in a world where you didn't have all those games, all these thousands and thousands of games? What if it was a big deal every time a game did come out, and you just had to pay for that privilege? Developers just changed how they went about everything. They had a one shot, a one chance, a one opportunity. Sort of like what Nintendo did with the during the Super Nintendo era. So basically, back in the day, if third-party developers wanted to publish their game on Nintendo's console, there was an agreement, there was a legal deal, and that was developers had to work on the game for a minimum amount of months before they were allowed to publish another one to the system. So in other words, you couldn't make a game which you just quickly put together and then sell it, and then a few months later bring out the sequel. It's not any good, it's not quality, it's just garbage. So what Nintendo did to maintain such a high level of polish, and it worked. Like, that's why the Super Nintendo is so fondly remembered, and Super Famicom, for those that don't know what I'm on about. It's remembered because developers were forced to spend more time on the games. So imagine we had that, but developers were rewarded for it. I don't know. I'm going to wrap things up here. These are just some random thoughts which plain Crash Bandicoot has brought out me. It's making me evaluate things, and who knows, maybe I've just gone crazy because it's just me alone talking into this mic. See? Madman. Anyways, you've been listening to Gaming My Whole Life. Thank you so much for listening. And if you've managed to last this long, well done. You've just been listening to my voice. That is a challenge. My voice isn't bad, but you need that breakup. You need the other podcasters, and they'll be here next time. So until then, happy gaming. Hope to see you online. You have a fantastic day.